Good morning. Before we begin argument today, I want to recognize the fact that it is a truly great day in the history of this court. Today we are joined for oral argument for the first time by our newest judge, Gregory E. Maggs, who was nominated by the president last fall, confirmed by the Senate in January, and appointed in early February. Greg brings with him a magnificent record of service to the nation and to the legal profession, having both served as an Army reservist, including as an appellate judge on the Army Court, and having taught law for some 25 years at George Washington University, including two stints as acting dean of the law school. Greg, we welcome you. And with that, is the appellant ready to argue? Is the government ready? Appellant may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Captain Mark Schwartz, and along with my co-counsel, Lieutenant Colonel Nicholas McHugh, we represent Airman First Class Thomas Barker, the appellant in this case. Chief Judge Stuckey, may I reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal?
Granted.
RCM 1001 Alpha permits a victim to be heard. That's not what happened here. The trial counsel was heard here by opening a door that only the victim was permitted to open. RCM 1001 was amended by an executive order in June of 2015. RCM 1001 Little Alpha set the guidelines for sentencing hearings and the order in which evidence, testimony, and statements are introduced. RCM 1001 Big Alpha was created for crime victims, defined as an individual who suffered direct physical, emotional, or pecuniary harm, and that victim must demonstrate a desire to participate under this rule. RCM 1001 Alpha was created and sets the ways for this victim to be reasonably heard in an accused sentencing hearing. Now, under 1001 Alpha, paragraph echo, it allows a crime victim to make an unsworn statement. That statement may be oral, written, or both. Under paragraph echo, subparagraph 2, the victim's counsel can deliver the unsworn for a victim upon good cause shown. And a victim who is a minor or incapacitated may have their designee deliver their unsworn statement for them. Now, in Airman Barker's sentencing hearing, the trial counsel moved to admit Prosecution Exhibit 8. These appear to be 3 letters, 7 pages in total, and at this time, the rules were not relaxed during this hearing. The letters are dated 2011, 2013, and a second letter in 2013. The letters are very broad, in fact, overbroad, in fact, in that they are drafted to encompass details of the author being sexually abused by her father, talks about the distribution of her sexual abuse on the internet, her seeking civil restitution, and all the suffering the authors had experienced throughout their life.
So, counsel, let's bore down a little bit more into specifics. Why was it specifically an abuse of discretion for the military judge to allow this information in?
Your Honor, it was an abuse of discretion because, first off, the victim or their attorney were not moving to admit this unsworn statement.
So is it your position, counsel, that the victim has to physically show up at the courtroom in order for a
No, Your Honor. No, Your Honor. The plain reading of the rule is that the victim or their attorney or personal representative does move to have the statement admitted. However, upon good cause shown, the rule seems to read that there can be exceptions, and the military judge may provide other avenues for that happening. But absent good cause shown, which we don't have in Airman Barker's case.
So I guess I'm just, is it your position that the person needed to show up? Is it your position that it wasn't admitted in the right way? Or is it your position that this isn't a statement that qualifies under the rule? Or is it all the above?
All the above, Your Honor. We have redacted letters, the trial counsel offering proffers as to what the letters are, no identifying information within the letters, the trial counsel admitting they don't know what the redactions are on the letters, the content of the statements are overbroad, as far as they go beyond any harm that would have resulted from Airman Barker's crimes that he pled guilty to, and they don't meet those minimum standards of reliability necessary for information to be introduced during a sentencing hearing, Your Honor.
If KF had shown up at the court and got taken the stand and made these same statements in an unsworn manner, would that have met the requirements of the rule?
It would have met the requirements of the rule, Your Honor. However, if KF were to testify to everything within that letter, certainly the military judge, per the discussion in RCM 1001 Alpha.
So then your position is then that she needed to show up in person?
Your Honor, absent good cause shown, the victim or their attorney, per the rule, are the ones who move to admit this statement into court. In Airman Barker's sentencing hearing, though, we don't have the appearance of good cause shown. We don't have a victim who's expressed an interest to participate in the sentencing hearing.
Well, we don't know that. We have some sort of statement from some time back.
Yes, Your Honor. We do have what appear to be three statements looking at the entire exhibit that were between 3 and 5 years old at the time of Airman Barker's sentencing hearing.
Are you saying that that's too old?
We're saying we don't know how the victim would have felt on the day of Airman Barker's sentencing hearing.
Is that a requirement?
It is a requirement that the victim does want to participate in that accused court martial, Your Honor.
Well, that's not the same thing. You're saying, well, on the one hand, we don't know how she felt, and on the other hand, does she want to participate?
Well, to answer your first question,
not exactly the same thing. I mean, she may have said, I hate this, it's icky, but I want to participate. I don't know.
Your Honor, certainly the letter and information would have to be accurate. And if the victim still felt the same way at Airman Barker's sentencing hearing, that would make the statement accurate.
Okay, then let me get to what I'm really getting at, which is why isn't this whole thing waived?
Your Honor,
I know what the CCA said, but he waived all waivable motions. And he didn't go after authentication. And why is the whole thing waived?
Well, Your Honor, there were several objections that were levied by the defense counsel.
None of which seems to really get at this.
Well, they do, Your Honor. He states he didn't know who the individuals were in the statements. He didn't have contact info for the authors. As a result, doesn't even know who the author is of the statements. He said the statements were not relevant and they were not being offered properly.
Well, okay. He waived all waivable motions. He's still covered, but he's still getting the benefit of the PTA, right?
He is, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, I mean, he can't have it both ways. He either waives all waivable motions and gets the benefit of the PTA, or he doesn't and he doesn't. And what you're saying is, well, that's okay.
Well, I respectfully disagree with the characterization, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that a sentencing hearing remains an adversarial process,
mm-hmm.
and the case law is clear on that. And Airman Barker certainly did agree to a PTA, but that did not mean he waived all relevant objections and possible objections at his sentencing hearing. And during the prosecution's sentencing case after the CARE inquiry, the prosecutor is looking to admit letters under a rule that was meant for a victim that don't meet the minimum standards of reliability. So defense counsel lodged several objections. Objections he still was able to
is
make.
Is there a minimum? This is not necessarily a description of this case. Is there a minimum standard of reliability for these victim statements, or are they just cries of objection to what happened or what is alleged to have happened?
Your Honor, the plain reading of the rule seems to indicate that
I'm asking, I don't know.
Our position is that the rule reads that there are standards because it takes a time to lay out who is a victim, who is proper to be heard, giving us a sworn or unsworn statement, what the content of that statement can be, and also make sure to provide in the rule that the military judge, sua sponte, can limit the breadth of these statements and content of these statements.
Can I ask you another question, counsel? Is it your position that this new rule with respect to victims and their rights trumps the government's rights under 1000b4? By which I mean, let's say we have a different case. So KC doesn't want, she's written out a statement about the horrible impact that everything has had on her life. It's properly authenticated, but she doesn't personally want to show up to the courtroom, and she doesn't want the statement admitted. But the government has it. Is it your position that then the government could not admit it?
Your Honor, it would be our position that this new rule would prevent that from being admitted, because this rule...
So the government couldn't admit that as evidence in aggravation?
Our position would be no.
Didn't want it to be there.
For the reason being that this rule is carved out for the victim and provide.
But what about the government? What about the government's right to present a case in aggravation?
And the government absolutely has the right to do that. However, I think part of the authentication process, and if you're looking at RCM 1001 Big Alpha, it does talk about a victim's desire to participate in that accused court-martial, which our position would be that it would trump the government's interest, because this rule was specifically put in to the RCM by the president to give victims their rights and giving them a say in what is and isn't introduced in a court-martial.
But how does the right of a victim to be heard equate with a defendant's right not to have the person heard if the victim isn't interested? How does that flow from the wording of 1001L? What specific language are you pointing at that says if a victim has prepared a victim impact statement but then says and presents it to the government, but then at the last minute says, you know, I've changed my mind. What in their language that appears there says that an accused has the ability to say, therefore, government, you are blocked from introducing this victim impact statement?
Your Honor, our position is that the call is being made by the victim. If you look at the very beginning of RCM 1001 Alpha, it states that the victim shall be called by the court if they want to participate. And if the victim,
but that's a right of the victim. I don't see how you're developing out of there a right of an accused from that language.
Forgive me for not understanding the question, Your Honor.
Okay. It's saying that in that language, talking about the right of a victim to be heard, you're converting that into the right of an accused to block a victim from being heard. And I'm wondering how you're connecting the dots there.
So our position today slides differently from that, Your Honor. What we're saying today is that for an unsworn statement under 1001 Alpha to be admitted, it does need to meet minimum standards of reliability, and the defense...
So let's focus on authentication. What specifically should be done in terms of authentication when there's case law out there that says you don't need a percipient witness, you can look at the language inside of a statement, and almost be self-authenticating? What is your concern about what should have been done, not in terms of best practices, but the minimum necessary to authenticate this particular victim impact statement?
Your Honor, at a minimum, knowing what the document is, where it came from, who wrote it,
The proffers made by the trial counsel on each of those points.
Correct, Your Honor. Even going back to United States versus Thompson, offers of proof are verbal proffers. They don't satisfy those requirements to admit matters within a court-martial. And there are minimum standards of reliability, and the simple proffers by the trial counsel don't get us there. Had there not been redactions, had there been an identifiable signature, had there been some type of...
Wasn't there, at least in one of the three statements, something that purported to come from, I don't know, Miss Vicky or whatever her name was? What's cut off, I guess, is what I think Judge Olson is asking.
Well, Your Honor, we're looking at 7 pages of redacted documents, redacted signatures. We don't know where they came from, but we do have one sentence on one page of one of the letters that make a statement of who they are, and referring to a Vicky series. And we know about the Vicky series having some type of connection to this case simply by a sentence and a paragraph of the stipulation of facts. But, however, there's no other information given about what the Vicky series is, how many victims there are in the Vicky series.
Well, where's the requirement for all this? We've got a situation where the accused has admitted to viewing the child pornography that includes the Vicky series. We've then got the document where the victim is saying, I am in the Vicky series, and then saying, this is how I am victimized by that. You're saying what you would like to see, but I'm asking, where do you find a requirement that additional information be included in there?
The requirement from the case law that sentencing evidence at least meet minimum standards of reliability, Your Honor, and certainly beyond the trial counsel's proffers, we just don't know who authored these statements or where they came from. If there would have been some evidentiary showing or some foundational showing of where these letters came from or who authored them, we'd have a different case here, but we don't have that in Ehrman Barker's case.
But don't flaws in authentication go to the weight rather than the admissibility of the item?
They do, Your Honor, but looking at
so
the...
So why was it an abuse of discretion? That's the important standard we're applying here. Why is it an abuse of discretion for the military judge to go through the analysis in terms of first saying, A, we've got the Vicky series connection here, B, in terms of authentication, we don't need a percipient witness, we don't need an affidavit, there can be internal information that authenticates it, and then the military judge says, I'm going to let it in. But it goes to the weight of that document rather than the admissibility when it comes to the analysis.
I think it's step by step everything happened at this hearing, Your Honor. We have the trial counsel moving to admit evidence or a statement, whatever we're calling it, under 1001 Alpha, which is reserved for victims. We have a victim who specifically did not want to be contacted. And looking at the content of the exhibit, we have very old letters that are redacted.
How do you know that, where in the record is it that the victim didn't want to be contacted? I thought that part of the defense's argument to the military judge is that the reason these letters should not be admitted was because they had not been able to contact, that they didn't have the contact information for this person, and therefore were unable to contact her to see if there was evidence to rebut it.
And, Your Honor, I can certainly get the joint appendix, but somewhere between pages 44 and 48, the trial counsel does state that victims of these cases don't want to be contacted, and so, therefore, the victim wasn't contacted, or words to that effect. But also in the SJR, it is written in there that the victim did not want to be contacted at all for post-trial matters. And Judge Olson, to get back to your question, we're looking at letters that the trial counsel is proffering that there's redactions. He doesn't know what the redactions are. He claims he got them from the FBI but has no identifying information for the agent. We have several letters. We don't know if victims are still alive. And the victims also talk about civil restitution. I see that my time is up, Chief Judge. May I continue?
You can continue to answer the question.
And the overbreadth of the letters as well, looking at them, that they go well beyond what Ehrman Barker pled guilty to. Looking at the totality of those circumstances, this was an abuse of discretion, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel.
And on rebuttal, I'd like you to point me to the exact place in the joint appendix that says the exact words that you said about the availability of the victim.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Major Ronnie Steelman, and I, along with Colonel Julie Pitvorek, represent the United States in this proceeding. The military judge properly admitted KF's January 2013 victim impact statement, as it met all the requirements under RCM 1001A.
Counsel, why isn't this completely unfair to an accused? We're talking about depriving someone of their liberty. That's why the government is introducing this. They're hoping it's going to increase the amount of time someone's going to be spending in prison. So here you've got a situation where the trial counsel is bringing in a redacted document where the trial counsel doesn't even know it's redacted, from some FBI agent with a victim who is claiming, but there's no basis for there to be any proof, that she's in the Vicky series, and these letters are stale. Why should this information come in?
Well, Your Honor, there's no requirement in RCM 1001. Trial counsel complied with RCM 1001A to start out.
Does RCM 1001A repeal the rules of evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. So that's.
Oh, well, that's an interesting proposition. There's your answer, because you can just toss anything in and it's treated as evidence.
I wouldn't say
well,
that.
Well, what
much.
Are you saying then?
Yes, Your Honor. So the United States' position is that letters presented under RCM 1001A are not evidence.
Counsel, that wasn't your position. That wasn't your position in your brief. The Hamilton case subsequently overruled that portion of Barker. What position did you take in the Hamilton case?
In footnote, I would point the court to footnote 6 of our brief, and in that footnote, we provided the alternative argument that authentication and foundation don't apply in this situation, and with that position has been bolstered now by Hamilton.
Is it your position, counsel, that the government doesn't have to even contact the person, doesn't have to themselves contact the person whose letter they're going to admit, and does not have to provide the contact information themselves to the defense? Instead, they can say, take the position to the military judge, well, they need to contact the FBI?
Yes, Your Honor, I don't think that.
Because, I mean, I don't read the rule quite that broadly.
Mm-hmm. Your Honor, Article 6B provides that privacy be given to victims.
Well, yeah, if the victim... You talk to the victim, you're the government, you talk to the victim says, whatever. But that's not what happened.
Right, Your Honor. The truth is we don't have a lot of information about the origin of these statements, but we've got the fact that they came from...
The truth is we don't know where these statements came
from, but we
can toss them in anyway under this rule.
Well, Your Honor, we've got a situation where the trial counsel... provided the information that these statements were obtained from the FBI. So there's a certain indicia of reliability that comes from that.
Mr. Hoover, call your office.
But that was not the fact that these statements came from the FBI. The fact that these statements were legitimately from KF and they were written by KF was not disputed.
We don't know
by the
that.
Defense. Well, this wasn't disputed by the defense
well,
at trial.
Well, counsel, they didn't, you're not addressing my problem, which is, I'll say fine. They came from the FBI, and the FBI said that they came from KF, and the stipulation of fact says that KF was in the Vicky series.
Correct. Right? Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay? But you don't see it as at all problematic that these letters from KF, that the government, this government, the trial counsel in this case,
yes, Your Honor,
didn't talk to KF and didn't provide the contact information for KF to the defense so that they could, if they chose, see if they could rebut the information in the letters. For instance, KF is this person, and KF, contrary to what you're saying, has a PhD in mathematics, you know, from Stanford, mm-hmm. and makes $10 million a year at a trust fund, right?
Yes, Your Honor. So
hedge fund, not a trust fund.
yes, Your Honor, I understand. I got you. So RCM clearly provides the opportunity for defense counsel or trial counsel to rebut these statements. That does not mean that they have the opportunity to interview KF. Or look in, you know.
Or even know who KF is.
Yeah, correct, Your Honor. I don't believe it does. These statements came from a legitimate source. Clearly, on the face of these statements were written by KF in anticipation of litigation. There's, I don't know, how hundreds of cases probably that have gone on where she has been a victim in these cases, and she's
Counsel.
Not. Yes, Your Honor.
Suppose we disagree with you and conclude that these statements should not have been considered. What is the standard for reviewing that error? In your brief, you treat it as erroneously admitted evidence, but now you're saying it's not evidence. What is the standard of review?
It's an interesting question, Your Honor. I would say still this court would still look to an erroneously, whether the introduction of this testimony in some way substantially influence the sentence. I think that would be the standard this court would still look at.
So what would the government's position be about when, in a similar scenario, the evidence would not be admissible? what defects, what deficiencies would have to be present either in terms of the authentication process or
sure.
what's contained in that material where the government would say, yeah, that's even too far for us?
Sure. Yes, Your Honor. Great question. So, again, you know, the requirement is that this still has to conform with the requirements of 1001A. So 1001A sets up a scope. This has to include victim impact. So, you know, there's arguably things that could fall outside of that. If the statement talks about something completely irrelevant to this case or to the crimes that appellant committed, that potentially could be something that shouldn't have been admitted, I would say.
So if trial counsel receives an email from someone purporting to be a sheriff out west and says, hey, I'm attaching a document here from person X who purports to be in the Vicky series and who purports to have suffered as a consequence, that comes in.
I think the trial counsel would need to have some due diligence to ensure he knows that this was a legitimate
But what
statement.
Due diligence was done here?
Well, we've got the fact that apparently there's some process that has been set up to where these statements
Okay, but you've just used the word apparently.
Yes, Your Honor.
We're not dealing with apparentlys. We're dealing with the record.
Yes, Your Honor. The issue here is that defense didn't object to this in the first place, so the trial counsel didn't have to put on the origin of these statements or that they came from
the party who is proffering the evidence, though, has the burden of proving that it should be
correct.
So wait a minute.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you're trying to shift the burden onto the defense about how they didn't object. But the question is, where in the record, we were just talking about this potential sheriff situation, and
correct.
You were saying, well, they should have done due diligence. Where in the record is the due diligence here?
So trial counsel reached out to the FBI. And
who was the FBI? What was the name of the agent?
The record's not clear on that, Your Honor. Again,
well, is the record not clear, or is it not in the record?
Well, you can just see based on the face of the statements that they're written by. Again, they say they have the word Vicky in them. They were written clearly by the victim in the Vicky series.
Well, they purport to be written by the victim in the Vicky series. But, I mean, here you've got the FBI. I think you're treating the FBI as self-authenticating. And here's the sheriff of Reno County. And so it pops up coming in the mail from the sheriff of Reno County with five or six stamps stuck on it. Equally worthy of belief.
I'm still trying to figure out where you're finding this rule that says that the government can put in statements from people and hide their identity because they're entitled to have their identity hidden. I mean, is that true, too, of the offense itself? Right? That someone can say this person did X to me and the government doesn't have to disclose their name or contact information? I don't see that anywhere in the rule.
Your Honor, I don't see anywhere in the rule where it's required that they do provide that information.
Well, it's a normal discovery thing. You are putting, effectively, this is standing in the place of the person themselves. You'd agree that if the person was going to testify in person, that the defense would have a right to have their contact information, right?
I would point the court to, again...
Well, answer my question.
Yes, Your Honor. And in the Gray and the Clark case that I cited, which are federal cases, they're unpublished federal cases, but I cited those cases in my brief. And again, the Article 6B, RCM 1001A, they came from the CVRA. They're based on that.
And leaving those cases aside, can you point to specific language in the rule itself that stands for the proposition that you are arguing?
I would say just that the rule does not say that they have to give that information and also that victims are entitled to their privacy. And in a case like this, Your Honor, we've got a victim like KF who's her images are all over the place and she's not, she's...
Don't misunderstand. I have great sympathy for KF.
Yes, Your Honor.
This, goes to another question, which is why did the government even do this? It's like it's the Supreme Court has said that this is why the rules for child pornography are different. Why didn't the government just argue this?
They could have certainly done that, Your Honor, and I think that would have been fair argument that these victims are going to be victimized for the rest of their life, et cetera, et cetera. But they also, this victim also was entitled to have her views heard. She's clearly written a statement that she intended to be used in courts where people like the appellant are court-martialed. And so the government was providing that statement so that she could exercise her rights.
But it seems to me that the government is trying to cut corners. Well, you know, she has a right to be heard, but she also has the right to be private. Well, the two meet somewhere in the middle and kind of collide. And I'm not sure it's a satisfactory answer. The government's saying, well, we just won't tell you who she is. And that way she's heard, but she's private.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think there's nothing in the rule that requires a person to appear in court, the victim to appear in court.
The alleged victim may testify through the victim's counsel.
Correct. A victim can show up. They can provide an oral
unsworn
statement.
But that's not the question.
But your position is that the defense has no right to know who the victim is or to be provided their contact information. Because, I mean, I agree with a lot of what you're saying, right?
That's right.
Except I'm having a real problem with that.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand. No, and especially in a case like this where we've got a victim who was a child at the time who just this particular set of circumstances, our position would be that there is no right for the defense to be able to contact the victim, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the government could have easily solved this problem by putting it in the stipulation of fact.
Could have put it in the stipulation of fact, absolutely.
So going forward in other cases, this whole issue need not arise, and the victim impact statement from KF or others like KF could still come into child pornography cases.
Yes, Your Honor. There's other ways the government could have done that. I don't think that there was no error in this case. Obviously, that's the United States position. One thing, if you're putting it in the stipulation of fact, then it becomes a prosecution exhibit, whereas as AFCA has pointed out in this opinion and also in the Hamilton opinion, what they recommend is that this should be, if it's normal, it should be provided as a court-martial exhibit. And the rules, RCM 1001, laying out the order of events in a court-martial, talks about, kind of points to that also. There's the prosecution, they present their case, then there's the victim presents their matters, and then the defense goes after that. So it tends to look like that is the way that it should be done.
Major Steelman?
Yes.
Does your position extend to all of the statements or just the statement that the CCA ruled was allowable?
I'm primarily talking about just that, the January 2013 statement, which is the statement that the CCA permitted. We didn't cross-certify that there was error excluding those statements. So I'm focusing primarily on the January 2013 statement.
Okay, now with regard to that, I don't think the CCA relied on the comments of the trial counsel in arriving at its conclusion, did they?
No, they most did not.
Yeah. So then I'm going back to your position where, because you think these statements are not evidence, and correct me if I'm wrong, but because
sure.
you think these statements are not evidence, then it was okay for the trial counsel to essentially testify to satisfy any evidentiary or authentication issues?
To a certain degree, Your Honor. So in this case,
I mean, that's your position?
To a certain, yes, Your Honor. Yes,
I wish
Your Honor.
You would agree.
I believe to a certain degree. So trial counsel in this case, let me back up just a second.
Because that isn't the normal situation, is it? Trial counsel can't get up there and start testifying about the evidentiary foundation for something, can
you? No. Normal kind of evidentiary foundations, no. I would not agree that trial counsel can get up and just lay the entire foundation.
Right. So this is based on your premise that these statements are not evidence. Is that true?
Correct.
Okay.
Also, I would
evidence in the classic sense.
Correct. That's correct. Even if this court found that this was evidence, that the rules of evidence did apply. In this case, we've got trial counsel has obtained a victim impact statement legitimately from a victim through the mediator of the FBI. He believes that this statement is a legitimate statement that expresses KF's interests. He shows up in court and he says, I obtained this statement from the FBI and I am introducing this on her behalf. I think that's all the rule requires under this situation. He's provided a statement that as an officer of the court, he is affirming is from the victim.
Does the rule, I thought appellant asserted that trial counsel was not a proper person to put this thing in, that it had to be the victim or the victim's counsel.
I would not agree with that statement.
Or are we now back in 1004? Under 1001A, is trial counsel a proper person to put this thing in,
I think
leaving aside all the rest of this?
Yes, Your Honor. So trial counsel, I believe, can be a person who can put this statement in. I think defense counsel could be the person who puts this statement in.
What language do you rely on in the rule for that proposition? You're making a lot of propositions today that I'm not seeing in the rule.
Yes, Your Honor. I would point to, there's several provisions that talk about how trial counsel has an obligation here. They have an obligation to ensure that the victim is aware of these rights. Trial counsel, yes, Your Honor?
No, I agree with that.
Yes, Your Honor. And so I don't see anything in the rule, I kind of go back to the fact that I don't see anything in the rule that prohibits somebody from acting on behalf of the victim. The victim doesn't have to show up in person and do this. And there's a practical reason for that also. You know, this is a guilty plea, and we can talk about maybe a sexual assault case.
The trial counsel doesn't represent her. Trial counsel represents the United States.
That's correct.
Her interests and those of the United States are certainly not necessarily identical.
Not necessarily.
That's why we got Article 6B, right?
They're not necessarily always aligned.
Parties on one side and the defense on the other.
But I think even if the victim provided a statement that, like, was completely against the United States' interest, if the victim provided a statement that, you know, was completely on the side of the defendant, saying he didn't do this or he shouldn't be punished for this, the United States would still have the obligation to present that statement on behalf of the victim. If she didn't want to show up and be seen and she wanted somebody to do it for them, they would have that obligation.
Let me ask you the same question that I asked appellant. Is it your position that 1001 Alpha, right, trumps the government's rights under 1001, meaning that if the victim had written a statement and the government had it in its possession, and the victim did not want it put in, would the government still be able to put it in? Or would you say, oh, no, we can't because they didn't wish to be heard?
I think
even if it was a great statement and super authenticated.
Sure. Policy-wise, I would say that the...
I'm not asking about policy. I'm asking about your view of the two rules together.
I think that under the rules that the United States could do that. They could potentially present it under 1001 before, even if the victim didn't want to. I don't think they would do that necessarily normally. If the victim doesn't want to be heard, they're not going to go against the victim's wishes. I think that would be the normal policy. If I have a moment, may I please address issue two very briefly? Well, no,
briefly.
Never mind. Okay. Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. So just jumping to prejudice, even if this court finds that there is no prejudice in this case, that none of these statements should be admitted, there was no prejudice in this case. Number one, this letter only pertained to one of 155 videos. That were seen by the victim, by the appellant, so there's a minimal impact. Also, this was a military judge alone case, so it's very unlikely that this military judge was improperly inflamed by this by these victim impact statements that related to only one of many videos that the appellant had. And for this reason, the United States respectfully requests that this court affirm the sentence as adjudged and approved.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal?
I'll start with addressing the last question you posed for me, Judge Ryan. If you look at page 46 of the joint appendix, I need to clarify what I stated. However, though the victim didn't say she didn't want to participate, the reason very well could have been that she was never contacted, which is a requirement of 1001 Big Alpha, which states in the rule that the government or trial counsel will reach out to the victim and let them know of their obligations or ability, I should say, to participate in a sentencing hearing. And that's one of the other reasons that the Air Force has the VWAP program that does manage victims and get information out to victims. So this was another thing the government didn't comply with regarding this rule.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you agree with the government's position that this statement was not evidence?
Your Honor, we would agree with the government's position that this wouldn't be evidence in the traditional meaning of the word evidence.
How would it prejudice the appellant if it's not evidence? It's not evidence in aggravation. How does it prejudice? Isn't it more like just argument if it's not evidence?
Your Honor, we would say that it is still a matter in aggravation. And if you look at the content of the words within the letters of prosecution, Exhibit 8, it talks about a lot of trauma, sexual abuse, distribution of child pornography, the intense therapy that the author has had to go through from it, even affecting their parenting, the need for civil restitution to continue to make themselves whole. Arguably the most powerful information put forth during Airman Barker's sentencing hearing, and that's the reason the 1001 Big Alpha does have these rules and guidelines for how it's presented, Your Honor.
What is the standard, if it's not evidence, what is the standard for reviewing whether the error mattered?
Your Honor, it would be abuse of discretion for the standard, but the conclusions of law being reviewed de novo. And
suppose we agree that it was an abuse of discretion to admit it. The question is, what is the standard for determining whether the error affected the sentence?
How it affected the sentence, Your Honor?
And the question is, what is the standard for deciding whether the error requires reversal?
Whether or not the error materially prejudices the substantial right to the accused, Your Honor. And in this case, we have the trial counsel stepping into a role meant for a victim, introducing evidence that was not properly authenticated, generally unreliable, and even getting to speak for the victim in his sentencing argument. He states, "Let me introduce you to KF," as he's arguing for an appropriate sentence. The government argued for a sentence of years, and they got just that. They got 2.5-year sentence in the case, Your Honor.
On the question of prejudice, how is this letter likely to how do we believe that it substantially influenced the sentence when you look at sort of the horrific things described in the stipulation of fact?
Chief Judge Stuckey, I see I'm well out of time.
Please answer,
The question. The reason being, Your Honor, is the content of the letters. This personalized the harm done. Airman Barker pled guilty to viewing and possessing child pornography. He showed up and pled guilty to that. But what these letters have is content that makes the victim's words speak out. It talks about all the trauma the victim has suffered from her early days of the sexual abuse and how she's still suffering.
Well, isn't that a perfectly legitimate thing for the government to try and do, personalize it?
Yes, Your Honor. And has.
So how is it prejudicial?
Because they didn't follow the rules correctly, and they tried backdooring in evidence that was otherwise inadmissible based on the facts we have in this record.
You just said it wasn't evidence.
Information, Your Honor, okay. Without laying the proper foundation.
Okay, I don't want to string this out. Thank you, counsel. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted, and Court is in recess until 10:25.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 10:25.